Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. I'm visiting a small farm about an hour outside of Philadelphia. It's drizzling. I've been here for a couple of minutes and already my rain boots are caked with mud and my jacket is getting soaked.
How are you?
Good.
Good.
How are you doing?
Hi, I'm Maiken.
Frank.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming. It's a farmy spring day.
Frank Carrillo, the farmer here at Kimberton CSA, has been working since 7 in the morning.
What have you been working on today?
Today we were pulling out some old spinach plants from the winter and preparing some of the...
Frank takes me on a tour and he shows me how to transfer tiny tomato plants from their pots into the ground.
Make the hole and then the tomato can go right in there.
All right. And how do you sit when you do this? Because I could see, so I'm like sitting on my knees right now. That's probably not the best way to go, right?
A lot of times if I can stand it, I will like squat like this and kind of rest my elbows on my knees.
Even after like 3 minutes of this, my back is already like, this is unusual.
You find out about muscles you didn't know you had. So you start, you'll get sore in places you didn't know about.
The physical part of the job doesn't bother Frank. He loves it. He loves the connection to the land, being outside and running around all day. But owning a farm, which is still new to him, can be nerve-wracking.
So far this year, so good. Had to knock on wood there. Last year was our first season managing and running everything.
The spring temperatures were chillier than usual.
And we were freaking out a little bit.
They had already started a lot of their crops for that season.
So temperatures got down to just about 20 degrees and we had our first tomatoes and our first onions in the flats. And they survived. 20 degrees is pretty much the lowest they can possibly go before, you know, they're done.
They got lucky. Really lucky.
You can't really control it. You can try, but I mean, really, you just have to kind of roll with the uncertainty.
Farmers have to deal with the weather, with pests and diseases attacking their crops and animals. Their livelihood is impacted by politics and changing consumer tastes. A lot of farming is science, and the health of farms affects our health. So on today's episode, we'll take a look at the challenges facing America's small farms, from aching backs to plummeting milk prices. Also, some big ideas for saving the farm. Let's start with a look at a crop that many say could be very profitable, but it has a lot of historical baggage, hemp. American farmers were forced to grow it in the 17th century by decree from the British Crown because it was so important to England's textile industry. A few hundred years later, it was outlawed because it resembled its narcotic cousin, marijuana, which everybody was freaking out about. Here's a clip from the 1930s movie Reefer Madness.
Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell.
The fear of the reefer made it illegal to grow industrial hemp in America, even though it doesn't really contain THC, which is the substance that gets you high. But hemp could be making a comeback. Later this year, when Congress hammers out a new farm bill, new rules about industrial hemp will likely be included. Peter Crimmins gives us a sneak peek.
It's July. It's hot. I'm walking through what used to be a cornfield just outside Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, with a guy named Jeff Whaling. The corn stalks here are old, they're dry, they're laying here on the ground from last year. A month before this, Jeff and his crew threw hemp seeds by the handful, and they grew, literally, like weeds.
Most people would not believe that this crop that you're standing beside can't be smoked. Well, it can be smoked, but you wouldn't get the benefits or the effects that you're hopeful of. This plant has no THC in it.
These plants have the distinctive spiky leaves of marijuana, but this is anca. It's a type of hemp. It has no psychotropic effects. The plants are already about 10 feet high. They're towering over our heads. We're joined by Jeff's colleague, Erica McBride. In just a month, these plants grew from seeds to a hard trunk.
It's the strongest natural fiber on earth.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this, this is already, sounds like wood.
We're standing here in the middle of a hemp field, and it doesn't smell like one would imagine.
No, it will increase a little bit over time as it gets closer to maturity and harvest time. If you take your hand and brush by the flowers, then you can definitely smell that familiar smell, but it's not overpowering.
They're not planted in rows, but randomly and thickly. We have to push our bodies through these tall, rigid stalks that tower over our heads. And sure enough, that sweet, earthy smell of pot comes off on our hands. Jeff and Erica lead the Pennsylvania Hemp Industry Council. The council's lobbying to develop a hemp industry as soon as it is legal and economically viable, which might be soon. This small 5-acre field, about the size of 4 football fields, is part of a pilot program sanctioned by the state to test out hemp as an industrial commodity. It could be used to make oil, clothing, plastics, concrete, even high-tech medical products, but Jeff says 5 acres, 500 acres, 5,000 acres is not going to do anything.
We have one company in Pennsylvania who have said to us that they would like to add 5% of the outer fiber into their processing of MDF boards and underlaminate flooring. 5% doesn't sound like an awful lot, but it translates into 50 tons a day. Their one request is 35,000 acres.
If you want to go hemp, you have to go big. Jeff and Erica are pushing for an entire sector. That means growing, processing, transporting, manufacturing. It all has to come online at the same time or it won't work.
It's sort of like a chicken and the egg scenario. In order to supply large manufacturing, you have to have the acreage. And in order for farmers to be comfortable with growing enough acreage, they have to be assured that there's a market there for their crop.
I honestly don't think I've ever seen a material that had as much compelling upside as this does.
This is Ron Kander. He's a materials scientist at Jefferson University in Philadelphia. He's been researching fibers and composite materials for over 30 years, and right now he's high on hemp.
We're trying to get around the, the crunchy hippie sweater, that genre of fringe product that's used by fringe people, right? What we're seeing it as is a modern material. Advanced composite for an aircraft or an advanced material in a circuit board or something like that. It's just never been explored.
Ron is leading about a dozen graduate students to figure out just what the hemp plant can do beyond textiles. For example, it has antimicrobial qualities. So hemp could be used to make artificial arteries and biological stents that are less likely to be rejected by the body.
There are electrical properties you can get from the material in its carbonized form. Once you take it as a biomass and char it down to carbon, activated carbon, you could use it as an electrical additive to a material to get conductivity or something like that.
Another idea is to weave hemp into fabrics containing quantum dots. Those are tiny nanotechnology electrical fields, and they could be used to make inexpensive solar panels. But the science is just half the promise of hemp. The other half is the economics. It's cheap. It grows fast and easy. But right now, manufacturers are throwing most of it away. You can already buy a hemp product off the shelf of your local health food store as cannabidiol or CBD oil. It's not FDA approved, but plenty of people buy it as a supplement for epilepsy, pain, inflammation, and anxiety. CBD is relatively expensive because it's derived from just the hemp flowers, not the stock or the fibers.
All the value from the plant has to come from that 15% of the plant. Nobody has gone back and said, take the 85% of the plant that's currently being used for super exciting applications like animal bedding. So horses pee on this stuff. That's what it gets used for.
If Ron or some other entrepreneur can figure out how to bring the bulk of the hemp plant to market and make money at it, that will bring down the price of everything else. The fibers, the seeds, and the flowers will get cheaper. They'll penetrate into a wider variety of applications and, in a perfect world, be a more attractive crop to farmers. One of those farmers is Steve Bevan in Kentucky. It's one of the first states to legalize industrial hemp. Since 2014, the state of Kentucky has allowed more and more farmland to be used to grow it.
The production of tobacco was declining. The coal jobs in the eastern part of the state went away. The rural economy really took a hit. So the Kentucky Department of Agriculture was actively pursuing industrial hemp as a way of adding a crop that used to grow in great amounts in the state of Kentucky and many other states around.
So there's the science of hemp and the economies of hemp. But the legal status of hemp is weird right now. In the eyes of the federal government, it's still seen as a class one drug, just like marijuana. But federal law also allows individual states to give permission to farmers to grow it if the state government chooses to do so. Not all states have. Kentucky has, for example, and Pennsylvania is just starting to. But that inconsistency across the country makes life difficult for farmers like Bevan, who have to constantly explain to potential clients, investors, and federal agencies that what he's doing is in fact legal. If the upcoming farm bill can take hemp regulation away from the Drug Enforcement Agency and give it to the Department of Agriculture, you might be seeing hemp demos at the next farm show right between the corn dogs and the tractor pulls. I'm Peter Crimmins for The Pulse.
We're talking about farming and some of the challenges farmers face. American dairy farmers have been having a rough time. The price for milk has been declining and many struggle just to break even.
We have just gotten to the point where we're in this perfect storm of everything that can go wrong from our perspective pretty much has.
That's Frank Hartley. His family has 150 cows, and he told me that dairy farmers have brought some of the problems onto themselves and others were outside of their control.
We had several good years of farming. Milk prices were very good 5-6 years ago. Farmers added on, did things to become more efficient, get more milk per cow. We've had some overall across the United States, some great weather for several years that milk production continued to increase per cow. So we have a lot of milk on the market right now. Then you have things like the school lunch program that pulled back whole milk, then they pulled back 2% milk. Now they're down to a very skim milk. And basically, the kids don't like drinking it. And so we've lost a lot of milk sales there.
What about our growing appetites for other kinds of, and I'm using air quotes, milk, like almond milk or cashew, quote, milk?
Correct. And that has definitely had a major factor in it. People were switching. They're choosing to go other directions for multiple different reasons. And in some of the studies that I've read about, you know, why people are drinking almond milk, it's interesting because it's gone from, well, we have concerns about animal care, so we're going to almond milk. But a few of the studies that I've read has actually said people thought almond milk was just a flavor of regular milk. They added an almond flavor to it, and that's why they're buying it. And so there's a lot of education that needs to go on, but definitely the alternative, as a dairy farmer, we don't like to call it milk because you can't milk an almond. But there are a lot of alternatives out there that, for whatever reason, people are choosing. So that's hurting the regular grade A farmer in the United States that makes milk from dairy cows.
Do you think, generally speaking, as consumers, we are too far removed from the process of making food?
Yes. And that does not matter whether you're talking dairy or even vegetables, you know, for the vegetarian folks in the crowd. We're all too far removed from it. And no one has a clue how any of it's grown. You know, they just know, go to the grocery store and buy it because it's there.
Tell me what it takes for you to take care of your herd, of your cows. What's your relationship with your cattle?
The relationship with the cattle. It's a lifestyle. I mean, they are part of what we do, you know, day in and day out. Good example. Last year, for the first time in many, 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 many years, my wife and I decided we were going to take a one-week vacation. And all of our friends are like, what? You're going to leave the farm? You're going to go away? What are you going to do? Because that's what we do. It's our lifestyle. And the cattle are part of that lifestyle.
Do you name them?
On our farm, we do because of the number of cattle that we have. You get onto the larger dairy. They are named. I mean, they usually just use numbers as a name, but every animal is identified with their own specific things. So I've been on very large dairies that milk, you know, several thousand cows. And even on those dairies, the farmers, the herds people, the people that work with the cattle will tell you, oh yeah, be careful when you go in this barn because cow number 3492, she is really friendly and she'll knock you down. So even on a large dairy, they know their cattle.
That's dairy farmer Frank Hartley from North Central Pennsylvania. Farmers deal with changing consumer tastes and opinions all the time. Some years we want nothing to do with fat, or we want to cut down our meat consumption. Then the paleo diet becomes a big hit, and we all demand juicy steaks. People want gluten-free products and organic veggies, and many consumers avoid genetically modified foods. At the end of 2016, a Colorado county passed a ban on growing genetically engineered or GE crops. That's a big blow for Paul Schlegel. He's a sugar beet farmer who uses genetically modified seeds. Liz Tung has his story.
Paul Schlegel likes showing off his farm.
When we first moved here, this was just a little narrow gravel road.
He's been a farmer here in Boulder County, Colorado, for more than 40 years. And for him, it's a family business.
We live on the family farm that my father bought in 1963.
Walk a little farther. We replanted.
I farm with my son Scott now.
This is where we store our grain. One of these days, my dad will retire, and I'll hopefully be ready to take over.
But along with the business, Scott could inherit some major problems. Because in addition to their own private farm, Paul and Scott grow a lot of their crops on county-owned farmland, which was never a problem until November 2016, when this happened.
New at 6, Boulder commissioners say they will ban all genetically engineered crops on county-owned farmland.
That's a problem because one of Paul and Scott's big sources of income is sugar beets, specifically genetically engineered or GE sugar beets. They're the industry standard now, and Paul says you have to know what beet farming was like in the old days to understand why.
Prior to GE seeds, we struggled immensely, probably the last 20 years. It was a very, very labor-intensive crop. We probably had 20 people in a sugar beet field for probably 30 days out of the summer that it was absolutely required to try to control the weeds.
Eventually, farmers like Paul started turning to herbicides to try and fend off the weeds. But he says they didn't work very well, which meant you had to use a lot of them.
The adage was that when we were putting herbicides on our sugar beet fields, it was like chemotherapy. If you didn't almost kill the sugar beets, it would have very little effect on the weeds in your field. We've started to get a decline in our yields and quality of sugar beets.
Then came another option.
Roundup herbicide by Monsanto. There's never been a herbicide like it before.
In the 90s, agriculture corporation Monsanto came out with crops that were genetically engineered to survive their powerful herbicide Roundup. And in 2007, they released the genetically engineered seeds Paul was waiting for.
Thousands of American farmers are hoping to plant sugar beets that have been genetically engineered.
Modified to tolerate the herbicide Roundup.
So farmers can use that chemical on their fields.
Within a few years, 99% of American-grown sugar beets were GE. And Paul says for him, it was a game changer.
We have experienced probably a 50% increase in yield since we've went to the GE crops.
But a few years ago, sugar beet prices started to fall.
The only thing that keeps us in business today is the yields per acre. And if we lost those tools that keep our yields where they are, we would be in a difficult situation, to say the least.
Boulder County commissioners are still working out the details, but farmers have been ordered to stop growing GE beets by 2021. Paul still hopes that could change, but there's been a strong backlash in Colorado and around the world against genetically engineered crops and associated herbicides.
They have promised that they would get GMOs off open space when they were elected.
The negative effects on health from some of these GMO pesticides.
I'm in total support of your decision to transition away from GMO agriculture on county public lands.
Some research has shown a possible link between the active chemical in Roundup and cancer, but groups like the EPA and the European Food Safety Authority say it's unlikely. The jury's still out on other potential health and environmental effects, but Paul's more worried about what a return to older ways of beet farming will do to the environment. He says they'll have to use more water and spend more time working the fields. Most of all, it means going back to those old school herbicides.
We don't want to go back to what we had, because today what we have is so much safer and so much better than what we did then. I mean, I don't want my son to have to go back out and use some of the chemistries that were prevalent 20 years ago, stuff that didn't actually even work.
Paul says, despite those worries, he still wants his son Scott to take over. And Scott says he wants to take over too. He's just worried about what that'll look like once GE seeds are gone.
For me, it's really stressful because I just got married and we also have a baby on the way. It makes me worried about what kind of tools I'm going to have in the future going forward. Yeah, how to do it right and still make it affordable, and with the prices they are, we'll just have to kind of hunker down for a little bit longer and hopefully they improve.
Okay, we need to go to work. So
yes,
thank you so much.
The story was reported by Liz Tong. ~90% of farms in the U.S. are small farms with a gross cash income of $250,000 or less, and most of them are family-owned and operated. We're talking about the challenges these farmers face every day. Ann Lopez researches the health impact of farm labor among U.S. and Mexican field workers. She started doing that work in the 1990s.
Whenever I would go to a farm worker's home and start talking about even neutral subjects, such as tell me about your farming techniques in Mexico, within a half hour, somebody would be crying.
Ann says many farm workers have health issues from breathing in farm chemicals. They work long hours, make very little money, and eat a poor diet. Their bodies just take a huge hit.
I'm dealing with a woman now who I've known for over 20 years that comes to the migrant camp every year. She has 3 herniated discs and 1 disc that is bone to bone in her back. She's probably in her 40s and she walks like she's in her 80s. She's in so much pain. She's tried cortisone shots. Those aren't working. This is one of the things that I think kills them, is that after 20 years of being bent over in the fields picking strawberries 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, the back gives out, you're exposed to pesticides, your cholesterol's high, and eventually when your back gives out and you can't do anything, you just give up hope. And I really think that the combination of the pain and giving up hope is what kills farm workers off. And that ought to be a concern. The body is not made to be bent over 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, week after week after week. It's a prescription for disaster.
What about the impact of having to lift very heavy things, which is also often part of the job?
That's another thing I've encountered, especially among the Oaxacan farm workers that work in the apple orchards. I have a woman that's worked in both that I work with, strawberries and apples. She went to apples after her back gave out, and now her chest muscles are all messed up because she had to lift 30 to 40 pound buckets of apples into a truck over and over and over again repeatedly. I went to a webinar that was put on by a physician who addressed these issues, and he said ideally we would have mixed cultures of plants so people could spend no more than 4 hours doing one crop or the other and be able to use all parts of their body rather than just repetitive work and harvesting of just one single crop.
What happens to farm workers when they can no longer work, when they have big health issues like the ones you mentioned?
Well, what happens is their family members. For instance, I've seen several farm workers become disabled, and then somebody else in their family in Mexico comes up, a younger person, and makes an illegal border crossing, and then supports that farm worker. So it forces families in Mexico out of Mexico into the area to take over the job of the person that is disabled to support them.
Ann Lopez directs the Center for Farm Worker Families in Santa Cruz County, California. They provide tutoring to the children of migrant farm workers, and they fund sustainable farming projects in Mexico that provide better conditions for workers. Farming takes a major toll on your physical health, but it's also tough emotionally. A rainstorm or a pest can wipe out your hard work. You never know how much your crops will actually fetch. And it can be very lonely. Alan Yu talked to a few farmers to find out how they handle the stress.
Patty Niner works for the Pennsylvania Women's Agricultural Network. She set up trainings for female farmers.
We had a workshop that was on accounting.
So the instructor is telling the women,
you should have a regular schedule where you're sitting down, you know, once a week and inputting all your information into whatever system, you know, the Excel or QuickBooks.
And then Patty says one of the participants got upset.
And she just started to cry and said, you know, with trying to do this, the farming, trying to raise a small child and trying to take care of, you know, all these other things, you know, I just don't have the time. I can't do it.
That farmer was Amanda Ballingy.
And I remember looking at the ladies, I was like, can anybody tell me, like, is anybody earning a living from farming? And it was crickets.
Amanda was feeling overwhelmed with just how hard farming was. Here's something that happened to her. One morning, she got up to check on her chickens as usual. It was a little chilly, so she put on her jacket and walked outside to the large wire enclosure with a top to protect the birds from the wind and rain.
The first thing that I recall was that it was very quiet. Like, usually in there, you'll hear some, like, gentle peeping. And I remember, like, wow, it's awful quiet in there today. And as I got closer to the brooder, I saw the first chicken, and this chicken had actually been partially pulled out.
Something, probably a hawk, had reached through the wire fence and pulled the top half of the chicken out. The bottom half was still in the enclosure.
We found a couple with, you know, heads torn off, wings torn off. I think I counted 8 or 9 chicks that day that had been, you know, partially or almost completely pulled out of the fencing, and, you know, trails of pieces of chicks here and there. And it was just, it was gruesome.
Amanda had plans for that day, but now those plans didn't matter. The first thing she had to do was clean up the bodies and fix the fence to keep predators out. She said it was heartbreaking.
One, because now you have the financial loss of, you know, having lost, you know, these chickens that you won't see a financial return on, but also because of, well, my poor chickens. So as somebody who cares a lot about, you know, the animals that they raise, when you see losses like that, it's disheartening, and it takes an emotional toll on you as well.
Before becoming a farmer, Amanda used to be an environmental health specialist. She says one of the hardest things to get used to was the isolation.
It's not like going to an office job where you can sit there and commiserate with your coworker about, you know, the latest ridiculous standard operating procedure that's come down from the higher ups. It's, you are on your own. You are responsible for everything that happens on your farm.
Amanda says having support from other farmers really makes a difference. For her, that support comes from the Pennsylvania Women's Agricultural Network.
That's been instrumental in keeping me going, I'll say. And even just having, you know, potlucks where you get together and just laugh with each other and know that, you know, there's other people in the same boat. It's not just you out there struggling.
I also talked to Charles Roach, who used to be a farmer in Australia. He lost a friend and fellow farmer, Jim, to suicide a few years ago. He says that was a bit of a wake-up call for him.
Farmers tend to naturally think that
the seeking help is a weakness. Whereas I found looking at Jim and through my own experience that the seeking of help or just communicating with someone enables you to be resilient.
Charles had his own struggles too. He had problems with his marriage. The land dried up because of drought, but he got help. There are many barriers to mental health care. The cost, the time, and then there's something particular to farmers if you ask Cynthia Christensen, a therapist and farmer in Minnesota.
Most people in small towns know what vehicle you drive and they notice things. And so they would notice that you were at the therapist's office, let's say. And there's a huge stigma to that.
Cynthia used to work in a rural medical clinic. She says that whenever a farmer made an appointment,
I would tell the doctor, you know, when he comes back into the examining room, just know that he's probably going to minimize his symptoms because it's hard for him to disclose what's really going on. And when he gets into that office setting, it's going to be hard for him to really admit what's troubling him. But knowing that if he made an appointment, there's something really serious going on. He's pretty worried or he wouldn't be reaching out for help.
Cynthia now organizes what she calls rural resilience sessions at farm conferences, so farmers can talk to each other about their problems. Psychologist Michael Roseman, also a farmer, has been working on these issues for decades. Among other things, he helped run a network of crisis hotlines for farmers in 7 states. He says more farmers now realize that they need help. For instance, he points to what happened when the Minnesota Department of Agriculture set up a farm crisis hotline.
They were intending to offer community workshops to farmers, expecting that they might get 15 to 25 farmers at each workshop. Instead, they had 600 to 800. These people want to know how to become better farmers and to survive in perilous times.
Congress is also paying attention. In March, several lawmakers introduced legislation to give states funding for mental health support for farmers. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
We're talking about the challenges farmers face right now, the health issues. Dennis Hunsberger is a poultry farmer in central Pennsylvania, and he recently had a life-altering surgery. It was followed by a difficult recovery, so the work started to pile up. But he found new ways to get it done. Abby Holtzman has this story.
In late 2016, Dennis Hunsberger needed to have surgery to remove both of his feet after severe ulcers on his heels infected the bone. His wife, Lori, says even facing this very serious operation and the aftermath, farming was on Dennis's mind.
And I know he said he was determined to get back on that tractor by spring to start planting. And if you want to see a determined man, this is him right here.
But it took a while for Dennis to get back to work. First, he was in a wheelchair. Then he got 2 prostheses that reach up to each knee. And eventually he moved to a walker and then a cane.
He often lost the cane. Oh, where did I leave that?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I could get back to it, but I pretty well do everything I did before when I had my both feet.
Lori and Dennis farm 500 acres and raise over 100,000 chickens. And even though Dennis was still learning how to walk, the farm still needed his attention.
Had a cable break in the chicken house, and I climbed a 5-foot stepladder within 2 months of having me feet on, because I need to fix that cable to get the ventilation right in the chicken house.
Eventually, Dennis connected with AgriAbility, a nationwide group that supports farmers with disabilities. They got him funding for some tweaks to his equipment. For instance, Dennis drives a huge truck that carries corn between his fields and the mill. The load has to be covered with a tarp in case of wind or rain.
I used to have to crawl along the side of the truck to strap it down. Now we made it so I just have to hit a button and it tarps it.
Dennis hauls himself into the front seat, a little unsteadily, and hits the button. The tarp quickly unrolls across the massive truck bed like a convertible top for its corn passengers. There's also his John Deere tractor. It's bright green, from the 70s, and only comes with 1 step up to the seat, like trying to get on a school bus with no stairs. He showed me what it used to be like.
It's a whole lot harder with just the 1 step.
You can still do it, but it just takes a lot more.
Yeah, it's a lot more energy, and it's not as safe for me since I don't have the mobility I used to have. Yeah.
So Dennis got 2 extra steps put in, and it made a huge difference. Some things still give him trouble, though. It's hard not being able to feel where his feet are, and he'll still sometimes lose his balance. That happened recently, when Dennis was laying some drain pipe with a neighbor.
I was still walking around there, and I got off the loader, the backhoe, and fell down because of the mud and the tall weeds there. Got me mixed up in my feet. But I got back up again.
Abby Holtzman reported this story. America's farmers are getting older. The average age is 58. So having this kind of adaptive technology around that Dennis is using on his farm could come in handy for a lot of them. We're talking about farming and what it takes to keep small farms going despite changes in the weather, politics, people's appetites and opinions. Many farms have animals, and that means people like Linda Kaufman are a crucial part of farming success. She's a veterinarian in Stevensville, Montana. We caught up with her as she was working on some baby goats.
Okay, so I'm putting a local anesthetic in before we do the disbudding process. Most goats have horns, and most owners, for various reasons, do not want the horns on the goats, particularly the male goats. The goats that have the horns know how to use them, and they can bully the other goats around them. And so generally, if you're raising goats and are going to sell them, you want them dehorned or disbudded in this case. There's a paste you can use to put on those horn buds, and or you can use a burning unit, a cautery unit, which is what we do. I take you back to your mommy.
Most of the farmers call her Dr. Linda. She cares for local pets as well as the livestock.
Maybe she damaged it. I can't tell where she came first.
But Linda grew up on a farm. She started helping deliver piglets when she was 6 years old. So this life, with all of its challenges, is familiar to her.
So my story from back in the 80s was my dad ultimately went bankrupt. Part of this picture was, in that day and age, there weren't as many vaccines in the 80s and 70s as there are now for animals. And so, say, a bird would fly in that had been at another hog farm and bring a disease. And I can remember throwing out of our farrowing house dead pig after dead pig because this disease was going through our herd and there was nothing we could do. And we just had to ride it out. Well, you know, that takes a big chunk out of your income. It was just such a helpless feeling because there just wasn't really, at that time, there really wasn't any treatment.
And your dad must have been desperate.
I just know it was devastating. One thing I can remember, he was always more upset when he lost cattle because he was more attached to the cattle. And I can remember when one of the fat steers died, and it was, in those days, there was a rendering company that would come and pick him up. And so he had drug it out. And I remember seeing him sitting on that dead animal with his head in his hands over losing that animal. And that image is stamped in my mind as well.
So what happened with your dad's farm in the end?
Well, he lost it, and they had to sell it, and so it was a tough deal. I remember being mad at my dad for a lot of years, which wasn't fair to him. But I'd put my heart and soul into it, and I blamed him. And even guys that had inherited their farms, and Dad hadn't inherited his; he bought it, and that was part of the picture. And this was.
Was that during the farming crisis of the 80s?
Yes. Yep. Interest prices were 20%. So for his operating loan, he was having to pay 20% on an operating loan. And, I mean, as a business person myself right now, to think about paying 20% on borrowed money, holy cow. I can't make it.
Linda saw her father struggle like that, and now she feels like it's part of her job to talk to others about the challenges farmers face.
Okay. We can fix it.
Yeah. Yep.
She loves being a farm vet and all of the animals she cares for. Do you have a favorite or least favorite farm animal that you deal with?
I don't know, the pigs and the cattle, the horses, the sheep and the goats. You know, I grew up with all of those guys, and I have a particular fondness for all of them. The llamas and alpacas, I guess because I'm just not as used to their behavior, I'm not as crazy about those guys. I'm not as attached to them, if you will.
But the alpacas are so cute.
Oh, I know they are cute. But they spit. I didn't grow up around them, so I'm not always as tuned in to when they're going to let me have it.
Linda Kaufman is a veterinarian in Stevensville, Montana. In western Kansas and the rest of the High Plains region, farmers and cities rely on a giant aquifer for water. It's called the Ogallala. But they are rapidly exhausting this valuable resource. One farmer is collaborating with scientists to try out new technologies to save what's left of the aquifer. He's testing specialized sensors and sprinklers that reduce water consumption. Ben Kubrick reports.
Western Kansas is dry. We're talking about tumbleweeds and prairie fires. When the first explorers got here, they thought it was completely uninhabitable and turned back.
Once again, the rains held off and the sun baked the earth.
Later, settlers discovered the Ogallala, a giant underground aquifer. They figured out how to use windmills to pump its water and transform the semi-arid land of western Kansas into some of America's most productive farmland.
Every year, in the Great Wheat Belt just east of the Rockies, the fields turn to gold.
Diesel engines replaced windmills, and farmers started pumping water into irrigation ditches. Dwayne Roth remembers it fondly.
When I was a kid, I mean, you know, we actually had open ditches. That was our entertainment during the summer. We swam in them.
Dwayne is 53. He worked on the family farm growing up, and after high school, he joined the Army.
Yeah, I just wanted to get away for a while. Yeah. You know, I wanted to go see the world, so I went to Germany and Europe. And accomplished that at least, I guess, you know.
Soon after Dwayne returned in 1986, irrigation changed again. Farmers started to use giant sprinklers that sprayed fields in a circular motion. This was also when Dwayne first heard farmers talk about the Ogallala's levels declining, but back then it seemed like a distant problem.
We thought we had 200 years of water left. You know, everybody just kind of took it lightly.
But by the 1990s, the Ogallala was declining fast. Then the droughts of 2011 and 12 struck. Farmers tried to keep their crops healthy by watering at full blast, but there wasn't enough water for the pumps to pull. Shallow wells dried up altogether. For Dwayne, the droughts were a wake-up call.
You know, there's some things changing whether we like it or not or whether we want to admit it or not. You know, since I was a kid, we've withdrawn a lot of water.
Farmers couldn't keep pumping like they had been, but it was hard to know how to cut back. That's because deciding how much to irrigate your crops is an imprecise art. Farmers would look at the weather, the soil, their crops, but perhaps most importantly, at what their neighbors were doing. The big sprinklers flash a light when they're running, so farmers would get up early in the morning while it was still dark and scan each other's fields.
If you wake up in the morning and every center pivot has a strobe light on, and you know, you're driving down the road and you see all these blinking lights, you know, you ask yourself, why the hell ain't my pivot running?
And overwatering was safer than underwatering, so farmers tended to pump too much. But today, I'm meeting with Dwayne to learn about a new way. On his very official-sounding water technology farm, he works with researchers to figure out how to water his crops more efficiently. He's got all sorts of gadgets. To show me how one of them works, Dwayne drives me out to one of his fields in a white pickup truck. The floorboard is covered in farm tools.
That's as clean as it gets, man. This is the work truck.
Try not to spill anything over here.
Yeah. I'll offer you a beer one time. Now it's too early, man.
We drive up a back road past a mostly dried up lake and turn into a field. It's spring and planting hasn't started yet, so the ground is just soil and remnants of last year's corn. So we're kind of driving up
to this center pivot, and there's a little solar panel thing there.
Soil moisture probe. There's actually a probe in the ground 3 foot deep underneath the soil.
The probe has sensors that detect the moisture levels of the soil at various depths. That information gets sent to an app on Duane's cell phone that tells him exactly how much water his crops need. That means he doesn't have to look at his neighbors anymore.
You see other pivots running, but the best thing about everything is either whether you have your cell phone or your iPad or your laptop with you, all you got to do is open up your app, and that soil moisture probe, it's going to tell you, look, you know, you don't need to irrigate.
Scientists are comparing his water use and crop yields with other nearby farms to figure out which devices work best. Duane hopes the data will one day prove to other farmers that the technology really works and won't break the bank. He thinks farmers have been slow to adopt the technology because despite its scarcity, water is cheap here. But without it, the land is nothing.
I'm frustrated that something that was just so obvious in front of me that I ignored. And, you know, that's sickening to me now. And I'm going to do a lot better job in the future, and we're not going to give up.
The Kansas Geological Survey says only around a 30% reduction in water use is needed to keep the aquifer levels constant. Duane thinks that's doable.
If we don't over-apply water and just apply what the plant needs, you know, we could be irrigating for future generations and maybe hit that sustainability.
Scientists estimate that if pumping continues at present rates, most of the aquifer in southwest Kansas will run dry within the next 50 years. For The Pulse, I'm Ben Kiebrick.
Ben is a reporter with Kansas News Service and High Plains Public Radio. Let's end today's show with a poem read by California writer Gary Soto. He worked in fields all through college.
The wind sprays pale dirt into my mouth, the small, almost invisible scars in my hands. The pores in my throat and elbows have taken in a seed of dirt of their own. After a day in the grape fields near Rolinda, a fine silt washed by sweat has settled into the lines on my wrists and palms. Already I'm becoming the valley, a soil that sprouts nothing for any of us.
That's Gary Soto reading his poem, Elements of San Joaquin, on public radio station KQED. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and this week we had additional engineering help from Adam Staniszewski. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.